Well, it's good to be here again. I didn't know if all of you knew that my father died about 2 weeks ago.
No.
Oh, okay, so I was up in Pennsylvania for that. So my mind has not really been on Bible study for sermons. So I did go to the archives. So you may have heard this one before. But if you did hear it before, I'm sure you forgot it. And I actually did make some changes to it while I was pondering what I was going to be speaking about. So anyway, my father died about 2 weeks ago, so we had the funeral up in Pennsylvania, and all that stuff went on. But anyway, there's a college professor, and he taught computer science at Carnegie Mellon University. And as you know, in many colleges, when there's a tenured professor, especially one who's been there for a long time, they allow them to come and address the entire faculty. Sometimes they invite the entire student body, something called the last lecture. Now, Bill and I, as adjuncts, will never be asked to do that. But this is for tenured faculty at colleges and universities. In fact, at Ashland Community College, I did get an email this spring semester. There was a gentleman retiring there, and everyone was invited to hear his last lecture. So they do this, and they want to give words of advice, words of wisdom, tell of experiences in the classroom. But Randy, his name was Randy, his last name is spelled P-A-U-S-C-H, so I'm going to say Posh. Randy Posh's last lecture would be different, because not only was he retiring, he had pancreatic cancer. And his lecture was so well received at the university, somehow it got to Oprah, and he went on the Oprah show and gave the same lecture. And it's up on YouTube if you would like to see it. And it's very, very good. He not only talks about being a college professor, but about life and having meaning. So he did that. But have you ever wondered what you would say if you were to give a lecture, a last lecture? You know, what do I, alone, truly have to offer someone? But I believe that there's even a more significant question than that. If Jesus were to have given a speech or a lecture that was titled The Last Lecture, what would Jesus have said? Well, I believe that Jesus did give last lectures, plural. We turn to Matthew 21, beginning in verse 1. I believe this is probably about 10 days before Jesus was going to be crucified. So when they had approached Jerusalem and had come to Bethpage to the Mount of Olives, then Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, "Go in the village opposite you. Immediately you will find a donkey tied there and a colt with her. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone says something to you, you shall say, 'The Lord has need of them.' Immediately he will send them." So we know this is Jesus, but the most Bibles say the triumphal entry as Jesus enters Jerusalem for the last time. And it's approximately 10 days before he was to be crucified. Now, if you go through the Gospels and see where this had occurred, and then look at the teachings that occurred after this, they are phenomenal. They're some of Jesus' most well-known teachings. You can go home and think about which one of those teachings impacts you the most. Which one of those was Jesus' maybe last lecture for you? But if we just go through Matthew here, I'm just going to say there's one where Jesus talks about authority. That's in Matthew 21, verse 20-23. He has the parable of the two sons in verse 28. The parable of the landowner. Verse 22, the parable of the marriage feast. You know, there's many teachings that Jesus gave. We could go over to the book of John, and maybe Jesus' last lecture might have been the foot washing teaching about washing one another's feet. You know, there's so many things that Jesus said in those last 10 days of his life. But there's one teaching that has been talked about a lot, and that is in Matthew 24 and verse 25. Now, I believe from my experience, from the sermons that I heard in the church that I grew up in many, many years ago, I believe that the teachings on Matthew 24 and 25 missed the mark. I believe that they were interpreted incorrectly. So what I'd like to do today is focus on Matthew 24 and 25 as one of Jesus' last teachings. And bring to you, I think, two major points of what Jesus was trying to say to us in Matthew 24 and 25. Again, I said, in my humble opinion, the traditional preaching of Matthew 24 and 25 was flawed for several reasons. Number one, it was focused upon predicting prophetic events. And I don't believe that Jesus was trying to tell his disciples and those who read this book afterward that this was the section of the Bible where we use to find out and to predict prophetic events, which are sure to happen. They will happen. But I don't believe that's what Jesus was trying to teach his disciples when he said these words. I don't know if this is where we got this from, but in old Bibles, the old King James Bibles that I had when I was growing up, he said chapter 24, and someone, the Bible editors at that time, labeled it the Olivet Prophecy. And again, in my viewpoint, you may disagree with me, and I'm sure if you do, talk to me afterwards, send me an email. I'd be glad to chat to you about it. I don't believe it's a prophecy. I believe these are teachings that Jesus has for his disciples. It was called the Olivet Prophecy from Matthew 24 and 25. It is an entire teaching. We developed end of world scenarios. And we wanted to detail what was the abomination of desolation about. And we focused on those things. And I think by doing that, we missed some of the great lessons that Jesus wanted us to know from what he said when he was teaching this. So number one, one flaw, I believe, is we focused on predictive prophetic events. And secondly, where a flaw was, we focused on sensational parts. This kind of flows into it. We focused on war, famine, pestilence, and earthquakes. You know, if people who still have this type of viewpoint and this worldview are obviously talking about the earthquake in Nepal at this time. And where does this fit in? And I can remember a man who I went to church with years ago, and he was a tall man. I'm a short guy. And every time there was something happening in the news, he would come to me and he would hunker down on me like tall people do. Says, did you see the drought out in California? And he would do that to me every week at church. So we like to focus on the sensational parts. There is a lot of sensational things happening out in the world. They all are leading up to the end times and all those prophetic events in Revelation and the return of Jesus Christ. But again, I'm not sure that's what Jesus was trying to do in Matthew 24 and verse 25. So this led into something called headline theology, looking for prophetic events and the end of the world in news headlines. I just wanted to just let you know that news headlines have been going on for a long time. There have been political upheavals. There have been social upheavals. There have been economic upheavals going on for a long time. In the year 1905, in Russo-Japanese War, poor Arthur surrenders to the Japanese. Russia suffers other defeats. If I'd been living in 1905, that would have been a major event. If I'd been a Christian looking at Matthew 24:25, thinking this was a prophecy, I might have been trying to figure out where that had fit in. In Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which recognizes President Roosevelt mediates a treaty of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which recognizes Japan's control of Korea and restores southern Manchuria to China. The Russian Revolution in 1905 begins on Bloody Sunday when troops fire into a defenseless group of demonstrators in St. Petersburg. Strikes and riots follow. Sailors on battleships, mutiny, reforms including the first parliament established by Tsar Nicholas II in his October Manifesto. You know, there have been scary headlines throughout since there's ever been newspapers. There's also been social upheaval as well. In 1905, Albert Einstein's special theory of relativity and other key theories in physics were finally let out. In 1923, there was widespread Ku Klux Klan violence in the United States. There was also the earthquake destroys a third of Tokyo. Just like we had a Nepalese earthquake here recently, we had a major one in Tokyo. I can remember living in 1967. I can remember when three Apollo astronauts, Grissom, White, and Chafee, were killed in an Apollo fire. And I can remember the talk about that time. The United States is losing its technological advantage, and these things are happening to us as the United States is going downhill. I can remember in 1968 when North Korea seized a U.S. Navy ship, the Pueblo, and it held 83 sailors on board as spies. So we can go back into the news many, many years, and we can find disturbing headlines. And again, that can lead us into a type of theology that some people call headline theology. And the second thing having this type of worldview can lead us into is having a crisis mentality. Now, religious people are not the only people who have a crisis mentality. Secular people have crisis mentality as well. If the polar caps melt, New Orleans is no longer going to be up there. And seas are going to rise 10, 20 feet, and New Orleans is going to be wiped out. New York will be wiped out. And so on and so forth. So again, I believe that those were a flawed approach to Matthew 24 and 25. Well then, what are the lessons of Matthew 24 and 25? If you want a title for this message, lesson that I'm giving to you, I'm calling it Lessons on Waiting. Lessons on Waiting. I think that's what Jesus was trying to tell his disciples on how to wait. And it was written down for us on how to wait. If we go to Matthew 24, beginning in verse 1, it says, "And Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to him to point out the temple buildings to him." Have you ever done that? Have you ever been to New York City? My wife and I have. We took the bus from Allentown, Pennsylvania once. We went into the Port Authority, which is underground, and you walk the steps up as you avoid the beggars there and the people panhandling and doing all this other stuff, and you walk the steps up and you're on the streets in Manhattan, and the first thing you do is like this, and you know all the tourists because they're standing there looking up at the buildings. Well, I believe that the disciples kind of had that sense of awe too. They're in Jerusalem and they see all these buildings, and I've never been there, Doreen has, but they say that the sun, when it sets on, it's limestone, a lot of the buildings here, and when the sun sets or rises on those buildings, it is just a beautiful sight. So maybe the disciples were also in awe. And they said, "Do you not see all?" Jesus said, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, no one stone here shall be left upon another which will not be torn down. As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Now, we're going to read a lot of exciting things here. Things that, man, you know, when they happen and when we see them, that they could scare a person, that they could put a person under stress. But I believe that Jesus is telling them these things so that when they see them, that they will be calm, that they will not be stressed out about them, that he wants them to remain calm because they know beforehand. You know, if I was going on a trip and I was driving to, like, the one time I drove to Minnesota and I got to Indianapolis and there was the road construction that was going on, and I got into all that road construction that caused me a lot of stress because I can get stressed when I'm driving. I wish somebody would have told me beforehand. Told me a route around that. Or at least let me know to plan for 2 more hours of driving. Again, I believe that Jesus is not, the number one lesson on waiting that Jesus was trying to let the disciples to know is to stay calm. These things are going to happen. Now, in my past, I believe that these things that we're going to read here is, they were used to cause us to run a gun lap, to get excited, to get revved up, because we're running the gun lap, and I ran track. I can remember the bell ringing on the mile run, and when that bell rang on the mile run, everyone kicked it in, and we could see who could kick it in and finish first. But again, I believe what Jesus is saying is, I'm telling you things because I want you to stay calm. In verse 4 it says, "And Jesus said to them, see to it that no one misleads you or deceives you. Because if you get excited, you're going to lose focus and you might be deceived. For many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead or deceive you. And you will be hearing of wars and of rumors of wars. See that you're not frightened." He's trying to keep them calm, letting them know about all these things coming. "For those things must take place, but that is not the end, for the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But of all these things, these are merely the beginning of birth pangs." I have no idea where we are, if we're at the beginning, we're at the middle, or we're near the end. I have no idea. But Jesus left us a temple here to keep us aware that these things are going to happen, and to stay calm. Don't get excited, because they are going to happen. Verse 9, "Then they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. And at that time many will fall away and deliver up one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and will mislead or deceive many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold." Now, I find that too, as I read Matthew 24 and that's good. That's the one that I really have to work on. That's the one that gets me stressed out about. That's the one that gets me excited, and because I can see the lawlessness around us, and I have to keep working, make sure that my love towards those lawless people, that my love is not waxing cold towards them. "But the one who endures the end shall be saved. you know, he's not saying, he's saying that this is going to be a long time, that this is going to take endurance. It's not a gun lap. It might be a marathon for us, and that we have to keep on going. Verse 14, in this gospel the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. Now, verse 15, this is a very exciting thing, and we like to go back to the book of Daniel, and we like to see what happened in the past and what is going to happen in the future. So I'm not saying that there's not anything related to prophecy in Matthew 20:24. There is, but I think Jesus has a certain viewpoint here that there's a certain word here that we must pick up on. In verse 15, therefore, when you see, I think that's a very important point. When you see the abomination of desolation, which is spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. You know, there are some people who have left and have joined communes because of some people's prophetic interpretation. They didn't wait to see it fulfilled. They just listened to what one man said, and then they moved away, whether to be in Utah or South America or some other remote part of the world. But Jesus doesn't say to do that. He told the disciples, when you see it, because all the interpretations before that might be wrong. But I think the interpretation is, when you see it, you're going to know it, and at that time, run. Get away, if you can. But not beforehand. Then let those who are in Judea flee the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to get the things out that are in his house. And let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babes in those days. But pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. For there will be a great tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, or even shall. Again, I'm not personally against preparing for disasters, preparing for emergencies. But I think what Jesus is telling his disciples is, this is something that cannot be prepared for. It's going to touch everyone. And he says, I want you to know about it ahead of time. Verse 22, unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short. Then, if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe him. You know, people who are in excited and in a stressful frame of mind may be tempted to follow one of those people. But those who are calm, relying on the Word of God and looking around and, you know, seeing what they see, they, again, in my viewpoint, will be less apt to follow somebody. It says, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead or deceive, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I've told you in advance. See, I'm letting you know because I want to inform you. I want to advise you on these things. I'm counseling you on these things, and I'm telling you about them because I'm telling you in advance so that you don't get so stressed out, so that you can stay calm. If therefore they say to you, behold, he's in the wilderness, do not go forth, or behold, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe him. In verse 27, I'm going to just put this out here. There's several interpretations of verse 27 through 31. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, I can remember when I was on camping trips with kids up in various youth group activities, and there would be a thunderstorm. And it was one time we were on a lake in Minnesota, and it wasn't raining by us, but we could see the lightning off in the future. So with kids, you're always trying to think of different things, fun things to do when you're out there camping, because we didn't have all of our toys with us. So funny, the things that you can amuse people with. But we laying on the rock by a lake, watching the lightning there, and we were going to try and guess when the next flash of lightning was coming. So we'd be laying there, go now, and there was no lightning. And then next we land now, like that, trying to guess when the lightning would occur. But it was impossible. Every once in a while, somebody got lucky. So, for just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. I think trying to predict that is like laying on a rock by a lake with a thunderstorm going on, predicting when the lightning's going to happen. Now, 72, 75, 1900, and we're all still here. But whenever the corpse is there, now I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. And I forget what is the New King James or the other one saying?
This is regular King James.
Okay, good.
It says, for wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together.
There you go. Now, there are several different interpretations of this scripture. Some people think that the corpse is the Jews, and the bird would have been translated vultures, and they would have been the Gentiles. There is that one interpretation. There's some who think that the corpse is the gathered saints, and it's an eagle, and it's Jesus coming back for his church. And others believe it is the saints who follow the false Christ out into the desert. And of course, it's a vulture who's going to come down and pick upon those saints who go out into the desert following a false teacher. There's many different interpretations of that, and you can pick your own. But again, I believe that this first part is Jesus is giving his disciples a heads up. He's wanting them to stay focused, and he's wanting them to stay calm as they can, because we as people, we have emotions. We don't experience famine and pestilence and earthquakes on a daily basis. But when they happen to us, yes, we might get temporarily excited. We might get temporarily stressed. But we remember the teaching of Jesus. They told his disciples, stay calm. I'm letting you know in advance what is coming. Well, again, in my humble opinion then, what would be the next or the second great principle that we might gather from this passage? And that is that today matters. Don't be trying to figure out when Jesus is coming, although I'm not saying that we can't talk about it. Or I don't believe that we should never engage in some sort of predictive interpretation on our own. But I'm saying today matters. We need to focus on living today as a faithful Christian. Go to Matthew 24, verse 46. It says, blessed is the slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all possessions. But that evil slave said in his heart, my master's not coming off for a long time. So now we have the opposite extreme. We have those who are always trying to figure out when Jesus is coming. Then we have the extreme which says, oh, Jesus is not even coming back. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, and shall begin to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that slave shall come on a day when he does not expect him, and an hour when he does not know. And he shall cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites, weeping. There shall be there and the gnashing of teeth. So we have the one extreme, thinking that always predicting and setting dates of when Jesus will come. Then we have the other extreme where people say, oh, he hasn't come yet. I'll just go off and do my own thing. Again, the second point though, I think that Jesus is saying is today matters. We have to show and we have to demonstrate that we are a faithful Christian. Chapter 25 in verse 1. It's about the 10 virgins who took up their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom, and 5 of them were foolish and 5 were prudent. For when the foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them, but the prudent took oil and flasks along with their lamps. And now the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. But at night there was a shout, behold the bridegroom, come out to meet him. And all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the prudent, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the prudent answered, saying, no, there will not be enough for us and you too. Go instead to the dealers and buy some for yourselves. When do we need to put the oil in our lamps? Today. Every day. We need to check. Because I believe that this fits in the point that, you know, when the groom came, he usually came at night, blowing a trumpet, waking up the bride and her party, and they had to be ready to go at a moment's notice, and they had to have lamps because they didn't have interstates, they didn't have roads, they didn't have street signs. They had to have their lamps ready, and the wise took care of that on a daily basis. And the unwise, oh, I can get it another time. I'll wait till it comes and then I'll get it filled up. But it's today that matters. Verse 14 is the parable of the talents. It was just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. The one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability. And he went on his journey. Immediately, the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them and gained 5 more talents. In the same manner, the one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 talent went away and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. And after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. And the one who had received the 5 talents came up and brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you've entrusted 5 talents to see me, and I've gained 5 more talents. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful in a few things, I'll put you in charge of many things. Enter the joy of your master. The one who had received the 2 talents came up and said, Master, you have entrusted to me 2 talents. I've gained 2 more talents. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave or servant. You are faithful in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter in the joy of your master. And the one also who had received the 1 talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. I was afraid and went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, you wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you have ought to put money in the bank, and on my arrival I would have received my money back with interest. Therefore take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has shall more be given, and he shall have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does shall be taken away. And cast out the worthless slave in the outer darkness. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. What matters today? And Jesus is saying, when you get that talent, don't sit around and wait. And the ones who gained talents went out immediately and made that talent grow. Because the day they got it is the day that it mattered. So if we're the talent we're been given, what is the day that makes that talent grow? Today. Today's the day that we show Jesus that we're faithful stewards. I won't read through the section about the goats and the sheep, but Jesus, we know that one well, but if we see someone hungry, we should feed them. If we see someone who needs clothing, we should clothe them, and so on. Again, Matthew 24 and 25 need to be viewed as an entire book, not just one section on prophecy and forgetting the other. In my conclusion then, I just want to say that in my humble opinion, sincere ministers and preachers use Matthew 24 and 25 in a way to stir up believers to run a gun lap. I believe this passage should be used to calm people down, to run a marathon, because the Christian way is truly a marathon. It's not a gun lap. And secondly, I think it was used by sincere people to focus on predictive prophecy. And I believe, especially Matthew 25, should be used to help us as believers to focus on faithful living today. I believe Jesus will be coming back. I believe prophecy will be fulfilled. But in one of his last lectures before his death that he gave to his disciples, I believe that Jesus told us in Matthew 24 and 25 to stay calm during times of stress, and today matters. Thank you.